This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Ashley Thornburg. Coming up in the second half of today's show, it is time for Main Street Eats with Sue Balcom. But we are going to start today with snow. We have had a lot of it this year. Heavy, wet snow. And some people maybe want to curl up and watch a movie or read a book. Other people want to go on an adventure. And my guest today is very much in the second half of that category there. Wants to take many adventures. Lonnie Dupree is an explorer and an environmentalist. He has circumnavigated Greenland by kayak and dog sled. He travels around the world to educate people on the impacts of climate change. He will be coming to Moorhead on Saturday, January 28th, speaking at 2 p.m. at the library. Lonnie, thank you so much for joining us today.
Good morning, Ashley. Thanks for having me.
What was it about growing up in a Minnesota winter that made you want to experience even more snow?
Well, you know, growing up in Minnesota already anneals you for the hardships of a cold, dark winter. And so I guess it was just in my genes. And I really, as a young fellow, really enjoyed winter and really didn't like summers at all because they were much too hot and humid mm-hmm. for me growing up on a farm. And so I always look forward to winter and getting out on a pair of skis or on some skates and skating on a frozen lake and that kind of thing. So I really always look forward to winter.
When was your first trip to the Arctic?
Well, my first trip to the Arctic was in 1986, where I lived in the Brooks Range in a log cabin up in northern Alaska. And snowshoeing around the countryside there just south of Brooks Range. That was my first taste of it, but then on a more of a high-end level where we were actually doing an expedition was in 1989, where we crossed parts of eastern Siberia by dog team, going through all the Inuit villages of eastern Siberia and then across the Bering Sea to Alaska. Mm. And that expedition was called the Bering Bridge Expedition. It was to promote peace between the two superpowers at the time when Gorbachev was in office over there in Russia.
Take us back to those first moments of seeing the Arctic. Because, yeah, we can say Minnesota, North Dakota, we get plenty of snow. But it is really not the same as going up against kind of the enormity of the ice caps and the big change in the wildlife there. Can you describe what it felt yeah. like to see that for the first time?
Well, the once you get above the tree line in the Arctic, you get into the Canadian Barren Grounds, and then you get up into the Northwest Passage area where you have vast areas of rolling tundra and caribou and muskox and Arctic fox. And then you get a little further up and you get of course, you're in the realm of the polar bear. And then, of course, the sea is frozen in the winter there of jumbled pack ice moved around created by winds and ocean currents. And then you get further over towards Greenland, and then you got massive icebergs frozen into fjords that are next to coastlines that are very mountainous. And then it's in these areas where the Inuit live, and specifically the polar Inuit, where I had spent time with in Northwest Greenland 20 years ago, and more recently, this last winter.
Talk about the changes that you saw in between that first trip and then again in 2022 when you returned to Greenland.
Yeah, well, of course they were vast. One of the most sobering change I witnessed was I was in a fjord 20 years ago in the middle of winter, and the ice in the fjord was 7 feet thick. Mm. When I came this year, 20 plus years later, that same fjord ice at the same time of year was only 18 inches thick. So it went from 7 feet thick to 18 inches thick in the course of 20 years. So given that rate, that fjord in North Greenland will be ice-free in 5 to 10 years. So that was the most sobering thing. The other thing is that the coastal landscape has changed, because in Greenland, the coast is primarily mountainous with glaciers and ice caps coming right out to the edge of these mountains. But now the glaciers and ice cap have receded so much so that they actually have to create new maps, topographical mm-hmm. maps, to describe the coastline, because it's changed visually.
How is that impacting life among the polar Inuit?
Well, the polar Inuit, like many of the Inuit in Canada, they rely on sea ice to be able to travel from one hunting grounds to the next, or one village to the next. And without ice, they will become locked in their own villages, unable to travel, because it's very difficult to travel over this terrain because it's mountainous. And then further in terms of Greenland, is ice cap. So you're really locked in your community. Many would be many, many months out of the year until the middle of summer, where you could actually use a boat. And you could actually only use a boat about 3 months out of the year. So the remaining a year, you'd be locked in your own village, unable to move or travel outside of airplane, of course, which is completely expensive and right. really inaccessible for most of the Inuit families.
As you are traveling around and talking about this, how do you make people understand that what's happening in Greenland, which just sounds so remote and far away, impacts the globe?
Well, you know, the ice caps both in Antarctica and in the north, like around in the Arctic Ocean, that ice is important because that reflects the energy of the sun back to space, keeping our planet cool. So it's basically our air conditioning. And when that ice goes, it just exposes vast areas of blue open water in terms of the Arctic Ocean. And that blue water just absorbs the energy of the sun, increasing the planet's heat. And so that makes a big difference for all of us. And so it's, you know, we probably see the least amount of climate change impact here, right at 45 degrees north longitude in Minnesota, Dakota area. And so, but when you start going towards the equator, going up towards the Arctic, like up by Alaska, for instance, you see vast and quick and abrupt changes in the environment. And we see it here, too, because I live in northern Minnesota, and we never used to have things like wood ticks and skunks, and even possums are starting to move up from Iowa all the way up to Duluth and Minnesota. And so all these species are now moving further north because it's getting warmer. And also the tree line I talked about earlier in the Arctic, the tree line, where the tree line stops and the tundra starts, now the tree line is moving further and further north because it's getting warmer and warmer. And so people would think, well, wouldn't it be nice to have a warmer winter? But the problem with that is other places become really overly heated down by the equator, and then the upper parts of the Arctic become permafrost is melting, undermining the foundations and houses and buildings. It's releasing when the permafrost melts, it releases methane, which is 25 times greater greenhouse gas than burning fossil fuel. So it's like it's a thing we really got to get our heads around, and the solution is to eventually eliminate burning of fossil fuels as a form of energy and turning more towards, you know, solar and wind and things like that.
We're visiting today with Lonnie Dupree. He is an explorer and an environmental activist. He will be speaking January 28th at 2 p.m. at the Moorhead Public Library. Lonnie, as you are going around giving these kinds of talks, Are you ever talking to the people in those fossil fuel industries?
You know, we just have to be practical here. When I fill up my truck or my SUV with, let's say, 300 pounds of gas in the car, and I drive to Minneapolis, and that tank is empty when I get there, where did that gas go? It just didn't just disappear. It actually went into the atmosphere. And because the Earth is a closed system, and our atmosphere is a closed system, that gas ends up in the atmosphere. And so we're changing the chemical composition of our atmosphere in a huge way. And so this fossil fuel, let's say oil, which has been sequestered under the ground for millions of years, is now pumped up and then basically put in the atmosphere. It's changing our planet. So it's really, you got to just bring it down to the basics to really understand what we're doing. And that's just one car with 300 pounds of gas. Think of all the cars in the world and then all the houses that burn it and then all the factories that are burning it to create our products that we use every day is hurting our planet in a big way. And then which is acidifying our oceans and make it uninhabitable for sea life. And so it's really, we just got to get our heads around alternatives in energy. And this kind of thing is going to take not even though we all need to change our light bulbs and we all need to consume a little less, really where the big change is going to happen, and it has to come, is from legislation, governmental legislation from governments around the world. It's a big ask. It's a big ask for sure, and it's difficult because we all drive cars. We all mm-hmm. need heat for our houses. We just have to find a better solution. And because we're all basically been using fossil fuels for so long that we've become quite addicted to them, and so it's really difficult to change. But we have to make that change. You know, it's like being on cigarettes and then trying to quit cigarettes. It's a tough deal. It's really hard to do, yeah. But it's something we need to do for our planet, because we've been taking so much from the planet over our lifetimes and not giving anything back. You know, we've just been taking, we have to now give something back. And so we need to, and it's going to require government legislations to do that.
Right. It can be very overwhelming for someone to just hear about the problem of climate change and think, well, I'm using a reusable bag. I'm walking when I can, you know, and there is sort of this problem of when it is so massive, you feel almost paralyzed mm-hmm. that an individual can't really do anything.
Yeah, and that's why I say we've gone beyond, many of the scientists have drawn lines in the sand of parts per million of carbon in the atmosphere, and we've crossed those lines multiple times. And so we've actually reached, in my view, having been around the Arctic for over three decades now, we've actually begun beyond that tipping point with the Earth. And so where we need to go with that is we need to reduce our burning of fossil fuels greatly now, just to calm down the most catastrophic events that are going to be coming in our future. And we're seeing them every year now. And so we got to learn to be able to adapt to these climate change scenarios of extreme weather events. And then also start spending, the governments need to start just switching gears and mm-hmm. switching gears as fast as we can to mitigate some of those, some of the biggest effects of climate change.
Lonnie, so much of travel has the opportunity to learn about your own culture. And we sometimes question what we grew up believing. We sometimes come away with a better sense of appreciation for our own culture. Can you talk about some of the most powerful lessons that you have learned about the differences between how the polar Inuit and the people who live in the Arctic interact with the environment compared to how we are doing that in the United States?
Well, you know, many of the, almost all, actually all of the Arctic villages, communities of the polar Inuit, as well as many of the Inuit in Greenland and in Canada, are their carbon footprint's quite minimal because they're because of where they are. They can't drive from one place to the next and that kind of stuff. And they live a fairly simple, actually kind of nice existence where things are a running at a little bit slower pace. And they're not run by the clock, and they tend to go out hunting or go gathering or go traveling when the time is right, when the season is right. And so their lives are pretty calm compared to, let's say, us here in the lower 48 trying to, you know, get the kids off to school and both parents going to work and then, trying to take care of the mortgage for the house and the car payments and all the insurances and all that goes in with it. So we live a much faster, have a higher carbon footprint life than most of these indigenous people. Well, in the Arctic, as well as, you know, other places like in Asia and Africa and things like that.
How do you prepare for an expedition across Greenland?
The logistics of going to Greenland is very difficult. There's a lot of hoops to go through, and then there's a lot of preparations with clothing and food. And getting up there. But when we're there, we're traveling either on skis or by dog team from one place to the next. And what I ended up doing is revisiting all the polar Inuit villages. There's about five of them up in the far northwest of Greenland that I wanted to go revisit and see if I could find my old friends and distribute pictures that I took 20 yeah. years ago to those folks. And they remembered me. And some of the kids, of course, are now adults. So it was fun to show them pictures of them when they were like, you know, 6 and 8 and 10, and now they're 20 years older. And so so it was fun coming into a village, a little village, maybe a population of 25 or so, like in a village of Kekadet, and go in there, and there's, at that time, just two families living in there. Yeah. And then I went in there and had pictures of their grandmother and their nieces and nephews that I met 20 years ago. And so it really opened the door to a lot of, basically a lot of pantomime and laughter. And we, you know, so we understood a little bit of, they understood a little English. We understood a little Inuktitut. And so it was able to, we were able to just have a great time and visit about what has been going on in the last 20 years.
Yeah. There's a line on your blog, and the website is LonnieDupree.com. The town basically consists of one big family with the last name, and is it Dunek?
Yeah, Dunek.
Dunek.
Yeah. Dunek, what? Yeah. That family took me under their wing 20 years ago, and showed me the techniques they use for hunting seal, which is their main food source, both for them and their dogs. And then they actually showed me a lot of the area in which they live and how to get around. And so it allowed me to travel pretty intensely and have an intimate relationship with the land and the people there. And so I owed a lot to that family.
What will happen to places like this, though, when there's only one family or two families? And
the population will fluctuate in that community because that particular community of Kekadet, they're narwhal hunters. And so In the winter months, they're usually fishing halibut and getting seal and running their dogs. And then in the summer months, they're hunting narwhal by kayak. And so the village will increase maybe by 10 or 15 people in the summer months. And then, yeah, so it's a very small little pocket. There's another pocket called Siropeluk, which is the northernmost indigenous community in the world, about 750 miles from the North Pole. And there are walrus hunters there. Yeah. And it's maybe maximum of 35 to 50 people there. It's just an amazing life that is. It's hard to believe that this kind of lifestyle still exists on Earth, but it does.
Yeah. On your website, there's a lot of blog posts about getting ready for circumnavigating Greenland by kayak, and of course those sled dogs. Mm-hmm. And there are some delightful photos of these dogs. I'm curious to know what it means to you. What did you learn about being a human by studying these dogs and how they come from different places and they might want to be aggressive and one is a natural leader and one, doesn't want to do the work.
Yeah. Well, think of the Inuit dog, which they call the Kingmik. That's the name for their dogs. Hmm. Think of them as a pack of wolves.
Yeah.
They look very much like wolves, just different colors. They've been indigenous and they're a pure breed of the Inuit people for over several thousand years. And they lived a feast and famine lifestyle with the Inuit, you know. So when there was famine, the dogs were pretty much the last to get fed. And they're living outside in conditions of minus 70 below Fahrenheit with no house, just curled up in the snow. And they are probably one of the most hardiest animals on the planet, Arctic animals. And so these dogs are really the definition and epitome of adventure and raw and wild and everything about wilderness. And these dogs, you build a companionship with those dogs where your life depends on those dogs and those dogs depend on you. And it's an inseparable bond between explorer or between hunter and dog. And if it wasn't for those dogs, the explorers never would have discovered, at least for quite some time, the South Pole, North Pole.
Yeah.
They wouldn't have been able to map the north part of Greenland or much of Arctic Canada. And the Inuit themselves would not have been able to survive. And so this dog is the reason for the success of both those cultures, so to speak.
Lonnie Dupree, explorer, environmentalist. He has circumnavigated Greenland by dog sled and a kayak. He has led expeditions in far eastern Russia. He has done the first west-to-east winter crossing of Canada's Northwest Passage. He has the first ascent of Mount Wood, a first ascent of Jeannette Peak. Speaking in Moorhead this Saturday at 2 p.m. on the impacts of climate change and the importance of teamwork. Lonnie, thank you so much for joining us today.
Ashley, thanks so much for having me today. I appreciate it.
We'll have Sue Balcom after this news.
For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster. The North Dakota House has passed a bill that would prohibit minors under the age of 18 from attending drag shows and prohibit adult-themed performances in public places. Fargo Democratic Representative Josh Boucher urged the chamber to kill the bill, saying the bill is aimed at a certain demographic.
We already have laws in place that protect people and their own interests, and as the bill carrier alluded to, supposedly some of us are perverts and are not interested in the safety of children when, in fact, I think it's the parent who has the best interest of their children in mind. And so I would hope that we leave this up to parents. It has been said in public discourse what this is really going after, and this is going after certain people who live in our state We already have laws that restrict where people can perform with nudity or without nudity. And so this further expansion is nothing more than continuing to police morality, as it was stated by the bill carrier, to tell parents and other North Dakotans what they can and can't do.
Representative Brandon Pritchard is a Republican from Bismarck and one of the bill's sponsors. He says the bill was drafted in response to a specific incident last summer.
In June of last year, there was a cabaret performance in Bismarck, and it involved young children. In fact, a minor performed in that in women's lingerie, dancing provocatively while other children were throwing money at the performer. And in fact, in the public testimony that I gave, or the committee hearing that I gave, I showed pictures to the committee of what that looked like. It was disturbing, and I believe that that should be shut down.
The bill passed on a vote of 79-13. The Senate will consider it later. North Dakota lost 20% of its small-town grocery stores in a five-year span before the pandemic, and the challenges to keep them open have only mounted. But there may have been some hope for helping rural grocery stores not only survive but thrive, thanks to a bill before the state legislature to expand a cooperative purchasing project statewide.
Our rural stores really struggle getting that variety, especially with that perishable food, the dairy products, the produce, and the meats. And so by buying together over several different stores, you can still attract a supplier and get a lower wholesale price, and then share those cases among many different stores so that it stays fresh and you can sell it before it spoils.
Lori Sapu is Director of Rural Development for the North Dakota Association of Rural Electric Cooperatives. The RECs are supporting Senate Bill 2273, which provides $2 million in the next biennium to help rural grocery stores replicate a program that has been operating in Walsh County since 2020.
The stores that have been participating in this pilot project have had an increase in sales volume of roughly 20 to 23% over the last year, which kind of goes against the current trend of the decline.
Senate Bill 2273 has a bipartisan group of legislative co-sponsors, including two former grocers. For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster.
Support for Prairie Public is provided by Josh Beauchet, broker and realtor with Hatch Realty, brokered by Real. Serving homebuyers and sellers in the Fargo-Moorhead Metro, Grand Forks, Bismarck, Mandan, and Detroit Lakes area. Josh can be reached at 701-369-4839 or hatchrealty.com.
Hi, I'm Tom Russo. On the next Great American Folk Show, spellbinding singer-songwriter and anti-folk hero Diane Cluck.
Oh, I was in the coal mine picking up dirt so heavy I had to leave them all behind.
Baltimore roots band Geraldine.
100 hammers can't break my heart.
Plus Canadian luthier Dion James, English poet Sherelle Ann, and I'll tell you the story of Grant Nelson's lost song, Sing of North Dakota, and I'll pay tribute to the great David Crosby. Listen to the Great American Folk Show Saturday at 5 p.m. Central on Prairie Public.
At night, when they finished, the humans went and locked the door.
This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Ashley Thornburg. North Dakota native Deb Marquardt is serving as Iowa's Poet Laureate. She is the author of a number of books, including The Night We Landed on the Moon, Small Buried Things, The Horizontal World, Growing Up in the Middle of Nowhere, a memoir. She's also a singer and a professor. And she is the featured poet in today's poetry from Studio 47. Patrick Hicks introduces us to Marquardt and how her background shaped her life.
It was a lonely childhood of hard work and few prospects for a creative young girl. After completing high school, she attended university, where she was only two classes away from graduating with a degree in social work. Marquardt realized this wasn't the path she wanted to be on, and she dropped out. She turned to her first love, that of music, and began touring North America with rock and heavy metal bands. It was a life on the road that brought her to a different city almost every night. This lasted for several years, throughout most of the 1980s, in fact, until one night a fire burned the equipment truck of her band, and over $50,000 worth of guitars and microphones went up in flame. Marquardt decided to turn her attention to writing. After all, it wasn't that much different than creating lyrics. And she re-enrolled in college, where she graduated with an MA in liberal studies from Morehead State University. She then went on to get another MA, this time in creative writing, from Iowa State University in 1993. Unlike music, which is often enjoyed in a public space with others, reading and writing is more intimate, more solitary. Of this, she recently said in an interview, "What's truly miraculous about writing is the connection between the intimacy the writer experiences when writing and the intimacy the reader experiences when reading. The world feels less lonely when you have that experience." Marquardt hasn't turned her back on performing music, though. Since 1992, she has been a singer-songwriter for the band The Bone People, and although she was keen to leave her rural upbringing in North Dakota, she returns often, and she has written much about the Bakken communities affected by hydraulic fracking. Her books include Everything's a Verb, The Hunger Bone, From Sweetness, Small Buried Things, and The Horizontal World, Growing Up Wild in the Middle of Nowhere. She has won a Pushcart Prize, the Mid-American Review Nonfiction Award, a Penn Center USA Creative Nonfiction Award, and an NEA Creative Writing Fellowship, among others. She lives and writes in Ames, Iowa, where she is a professor of English at Iowa State University. In 2019, she was named Poet Laureate of Iowa. Today's poem is Traveling with Guitar. I don't know about you, but I never learned how to play a musical instrument. This means I'm quietly in awe when I see someone filling up a room or a stadium with song. For me, it's like having a superpower. I just don't have the ability to pick up a trumpet or a saxophone or a guitar and then bring out rich notes that can change someone's emotions. And because I don't have this superpower, I don't know what it's like to carry around a musical instrument. I like how this poem gives me a little porthole into that secret world. Here, Marquardt describes what it's like to carry around a guitar when you're not playing it. This is Traveling with Guitar by Deborah Marquardt. For you can travel with a screaming red rolling bag and float unnoticed on conveyors through terminals, or you can lug half a moose rack from Maine to Minnesota, carry it like a broken wing through airports, as my friend Gro did, and draw only the curious touches of children waiting at gates. But dare to travel with a guitar and invite confessions from strangers in pinstripe suits of garage band summers. Invite winks, gotcha smiles, and devil horns, rock on, gestures. Invite finger points and winks, the long tongue licks, and the rubber neck glance to check if you are someone famous. To dare to travel with a guitar is to mark yourself charismatic megafauna of the airport terminal. Old friend, what else could I do but carry you? I have stored you in closets, propped you in corners, hunched over you late nights, staring perplexed at the mysteries of your neck, body of my body, string of my strings. See how the world began to hum and sing that day at 13 when I opened the big birthday box.
That was Patrick Hicks reading Traveling with Guitar from poet and North Dakota native Deborah Marquardt. Poetry from Studio 47 is recorded at Augustana University, where Hicks is a member of the English faculty. It is produced by Peter Folliard. Sue Balcom is next.
When you hear arts programming here on Prairie Public, know that it is supported in part by the North Dakota Council on the Arts, and we thank them.
Support for Prairie Public is provided by Jade Presents, bringing Dance Party Reunion, a salute to Buddy Holly and friends, to the Fargo Theater, 8 p.m. Friday, February 3rd. Tickets at jadepresents.com.
This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Ashley Thornburg with Craig Blumenschein, and root cellar Sue. Sue Balcom joins us once a week to talk about food. Sue, thanks for joining us today.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Hi, Sue. How are you?
I'm very well. It was a nice, warm kind of, we had kind of a very warm January, and then, of course, we'll be moving into some more cold, so we got to talk about food, because when it's cold, you got to eat, right?
Yeah, and I'm guessing you're just having, like, Eggs Benedict every day, right?
Oh my God.
Eggs, you know, have become the new filet mignon.
I know, and it's sad because eggs are such a staple. They're like the fourth most purchased item in the grocery stores in the whole United States. You know, and JC did a breakfast for a group that he belongs to in December, and we went to the Walmart store, and they were out. of eggs completely. And then we went to Dan's supermarket, and they were limited to one 18-pack, and it was $7.50. I about had a heart attack.
Yikes.
I mean, I was just like, and you know, I used to tell people about my egg lady.
Oh, I bet you'd keep that.
Heck yeah. Well, it's like nobody knows like where I get my
Fort
eggs
Knox
anymore.
Now.
And they're still reasonable and they're just way better. And so, you know, I wonder how many of the communities, you know, a while back, probably 2 or 3 years ago, people were talking about city ordinances against having hens in your backyard.
Sure.
I wonder when that's going to change. However, there is a talk about this inflationary adjustment with eggs is manufactured, but you know, there has been avian flu detected in the United States, and I know that the Gallup, the ag department that handles that, you know, that's, it's really sad because more than 44 million egg laying hens in the United States last year died from this. And I think it actually affects other birds, too, you know, like the the wild birds and stuff. And I have no idea. I wished I would have had a moment. I wished I'd have thought of calling the ag department, ask them a little bit about, you know, what are they going to do? You know, how do we get past this?
Yeah.
Hey, Sue, can I ask you a question about eggs just generally? I remember this roller coaster of science that says eggs are great for you. No, really, it they are not. Watch
Who
yourself.
Who is funding the study?
That's they are great for you. And now, if my recollection serves me, the American Heart Association says that one egg a day is okay. What's your take on the health benefits of eggs?
I absolutely think eggs are good for you, especially if they're fried in a lot of butter or bacon grease. you know, everything in moderation, right? I mean, like, you can't just eat 12 eggs every day. But, boy, I just think that, like Ashley said, I think it just like everything else. You know, coffee's bad for you, coffee's good for you. It depends on who's telling you those things. Now, I do, if you've not gone out and ever had a farm egg, that is something that I think that those eggs are probably higher in nutrients than the ones in the grocery store, A, because they're fresher, B, I don't know if mine are actually washed. You know, washing takes the bloom off an egg. An egg, I had an Amish person tell me, or a Hutterite person tell me that eggs are good 2 weeks on the counter because they have a natural bloom on them once they're laid that is kind of like a protective sort of coating on the shell. And then, of course, you know, we keep ours in the refrigerator. My grandmother never did. You know,
right.
I remember going there for Easter one time and having a hard-boiled egg. I thought it was a hard-boiled egg till the yolk dripped down my chin when I bit into it. And I was just like,
oh, dear.
It was bad. And I'm not recommending that you leave your eggs out on the counter. You have to know, A, who's growing your eggs if you're buying them off the farm, and B, you have to know if they're, like, very clean people. You know, there's some – I've seen eggs that come out of this dirty straw, and it's just not very appealing. But the gal I buy mine from, hers are immaculate. And then, of course, I have friends that have chickens, and this one gal has a chicken coop that's probably more expensive than my house. So I always call it her chicken chalet, and she gives me eggs once in a while. They're just beautiful. Mm. And they're green. You know, eggs come in different colors.
Right.
And they don't have a stamp on them. Like one brand of eggs, which, can I mention that? Eglin's Best. I thought, oh, I'm going to buy the best eggs there are out there in the grocery store. And I opened up the container, and I'm like, is that chicken tattooing those eggs? Every one of them had the same mark on in the same spot. And that kind of like made me think maybe I don't want to buy those eggs. So, but anyway.
Well, Sue, let's talk about some substitutions for eggs. Or maybe you can kind of thin them out sometimes and make them last a little bit longer. Because if they are costing 200% or more than kind of average, that really takes a toll.
Right, because I saw in the news last night, I think that the guy at Kroll's Kitchen here in Bismarck said that they went from $3.50 a box of 70 to like $65, and they use eggs in everything. You know, like every time you bake, my Pfeffernuss cookies uses a half a dozen eggs in the recipe.
Mm-hmm.
So one of the things that you can do is kind of like look for recipes that don't use so many eggs, which is really kind of, you know, it's kind of hard because I always like to have two eggs with breakfast, you know, and they're suggesting that you only have one, and I really love hard-boiled eggs. But, you know, instead of making an egg bake, you can make a dish with, like, creamy carbonara or a veggie bowl, you know, that has a little bit less than two eggs per serving, you know, when you kind of stretch it out like that. And, of course, I've often heard that you can use chickpea
water, aquafaba.
Yes, you can use that for an egg substitute. But, you know, if you take flax seeds, I don't know if you've ever done that. If you can take a cup of flax seeds and put water in, it becomes really gelatinous. And you can use that to substitute eggs. You can grind flax seed and use that as a substitute for eggs. Now, you're not going to get the same consistency like in baked items, for sure, because eggs are part of the rising process. You know, like in a chiffon cake, that's mostly eggs. Angel food cake, that's mostly beaten egg whites with sugar in them. So back in the day when they made angel food cakes for people's birthdays, then they would take the whites for the angel food cake, and then you'd use the yolks to make a nice creamy ice cream for over the top of your cake, you know, when you got a birthday celebration. I'm not saying we did that all the time. There's substitutes, protein substitutes, you know, like tofu, which I know my husband doesn't think he likes, but, you know, sometimes he does. What you don't know don't hurt you, right?
Are you sneaking tofu
into things? I love tofu. I always order tofu in my vegetable stir fry at the Chinese restaurant. So we're hoping, like we're really, really hoping that if you're having to skip your eggs or you can't go into Perkins and have a great big hearty breakfast, that maybe eggs will start to go down in price, or maybe more people will start having chickens in their backyards. And I would love to have chickens, or I need to search out the eggs that those 50 turkeys I have in my yard right now are laying. I never thought of that till right this minute. Maybe that would be what I can do. I think you know, there's goose eggs that people eat. They actually say they're better for baking because they rise better in the oven. You know, they whip up, you know, fluffier and stuff. So, I don't know. Do you like eggs?
I love eggs.
Yeah.
Oh, God, me too. I don't know. I can live without them.
I didn't used to. But now every other day I have two eggs and some bacon for breakfast just every other day. And, man, I really look forward to it. I would dislike not being able to have as many eggs, I think.
Right, and if you skip the toast with that, they say that especially women that want to keep their weight down should actually have a protein like an egg in the morning, a couple eggs in the morning, and maybe meat if they so choose. And, you know, skip the bread, which I'm sorry because I really like toast. But
There's no carbs here, right?
Right. Eggs are really good for you. And, oh, do you know how to tell a old egg from a new egg?
It has something to do with putting it in water, right?
Actually, if you break them open, if you break open an egg in the pan.
It's too late then, yeah. Sue, right?
Well, I suppose if you look at it that way, I've never let an egg go to waste in my – oh, no, I that's not true. One time I think I let a dozen eggs sit for way too long. You know, those shells are porous, and they go through these changes, but – if you're going to hard boil an egg, use your older eggs. If you're going to eat an egg, use the ones that you just bought. But you can, once you open it up and put it in the pan, if the white holds together, then it's a fresher egg than if they get like all runny all over the place. But we still eat them. Like, don't get me wrong. I still eat those eggs that aren't, you know, so fresh.
What is the trick to knowing that, though, before you crack it? Isn't there something about putting it in water?
Whether it floats or not.
Yeah.
Yes. And that is because the volume inside the egg changes through those pores in the shell, like I'd mentioned earlier, and I've seen it with my own eyes, and then they stink when you open up. But if they float, that means that they don't have anything left inside of them, that the white's been evaporating, and they're really bad. And we all know, based on our experiences in science class when we were in high school, what rotten eggs smell like, right? It is not very pleasant at all. So
what about if it is an egg dish, let's just say an omelet, is there something you can add, a little bit more water or I don't know, maybe even a little bit of beer or something to where
I would suggest beer over milk because milk makes them heavier, you know, like JC and I have this argument all the time over whether we should put milk in an omelet or water in an omelet. And water lightens up your egg yolks or your eggs, and milk makes it a little bit heavier. Although, you know, one of my favorite ways to make eggs now, you take like a muffin tin. And this would be like if you had a bunch of people over for breakfast, muffin tin or popover pan or something like that, or little what are those little ramekins? And you put like 2 or 3 tablespoons of cream in there and crack an egg over that and bake that in the oven for 7 or 8 minutes till the yolk is the right hardness or softness, depending upon your likes. Man, they are the creamiest, most wonderful eggs on the planet. And the cream never hurts, you know, a little cream. Cream is just liquid butter. We eat way too much butter at our house. I can tell you that right now. So,
how do you decide for an egg substitute when you would want to use, for example, flax and water, or when you would use applesauce, or maybe even they sell something called egg replacer, which I think is primarily a potato starch.
Oh, could be. And they also sell powdered eggs, too. And I don't know if those are as expensive as real eggs. You know, substituting things, a lot of the newer recipe blogs that I read, they actually have a list of things that you can substitute for certain ingredients. But it is all a crapshoot. You know, like you can use yogurt or applesauce. That works really good for, you know, keeping things moist. But when it comes to rising, I don't know if there's really anything that you can substitute completely.
You can't
for
just
eggs.
Add more baking soda or anything?
No, no. Baking soda will make that bitter taste in any of your baked goods, you know, that little metallic taste in the back of your mouth. So it is totally a crapshoot, and I would never go whole hog. You know, like I would never, if a recipe calls for 3 eggs, I would never replace all 3 of those eggs. Oh. I might replace 1 or 2 of them if I'm feeling brave. But if you do a lot of baking and you experiment a little bit with that kind of stuff, I've never met a baked item that wasn't edible when it came out of the oven in one way, shape, or form. So, but yeah, I would be careful about that. Eggs are a very important part of baking in my mind.
Sue, do you think we're going to see a price fall here this summer?
Oh,
is that
gosh.
What's on your plate here?
I am praying for one. But, you know, it's kind of like everything else goes up, and it never, ever really goes down. There's an interesting article I read about, what are they, shrinkonomics is what they call it. You know, like,
oh, sure.
If they keep the price.
The price is the same, but
you get
the
box
third
is
as many
smaller,
chips.
Yes.
Yeah. 10 will be our new dozen, Sue. Is that what you're saying?
Yes, that's what I'm saying. That might be our only out here. Or you could all write a letter to my husband and tell him we need to get some chickens. And hopefully we can keep them healthy out there where we live, and then we would have all the eggs we need.
Good luck with that, Sue Balcom. Sue Balcom joins us once a week to talk about food for Main Street Eats, and she owns and operates the Root Cellars Farm outside of Mandan. Sue, thank you for joining us today.
Thank you both
thank you,
today
Sue.
For your time.
Dakota Medical Foundation is reminding listeners of Giving Hearts Day, Thursday, February 9th. Since 2008, this initiative has helped charities across North Dakota and Northwest Minnesota raise nearly $140 million. Learn more at givingheartsday.org.
This is Dakota Datebook for January 26th. According to North Dakota State University Extension and Ag Research News, rabbits are responsible for killing more trees in winter than cold temperatures. Rabbits eat the bark off young trees, especially fruit trees, to get to the sugar-rich tissue just below the bark. If a tree loses bark all the way around its circumference, it's likely going to die. Arborists are accustomed to fighting a running battle with rabbits. Plastic pipes and wraps can protect the trees, but when there's substantial snow buildup, the rabbits will just climb the drifts and eat the bark higher. Arborists know that the work of years can be gone over the course of one winter. On this date, in 1916, the Fargo Forum and Daily Republican alerted readers to a jackrabbit invasion. Farmers reported an influx of tree-eating, dog-fighting, and thieving rabbits. Farmers were suffering significant losses and great aggravation. One farmer said he sent his farm dog out to chase off a big jackrabbit. The rabbit fought with the dog for 15 minutes until the rabbit finally took to its heels. But the dog was now afraid of rabbits. Another farmer had a similar tale. He said his usually reliable hunting dog would have nothing to do with rabbits. Other farmers reported damaged stores of hay as well as trees. The rabbit problem was not confined to the countryside. A Fargo night watchman reported that rabbits were doing scavenger work in town. They came out at night and helped themselves to the contents of trash cans. He noted that more and more of them were coming in every night. Jackrabbits continue to cause aggravation in North Dakota. In the winter of 2015, it was widely reported that rabbits were invading neighborhoods. The Christian Science Monitor published an article about rabbits the size of small dogs, creating havoc for Fargo homeowners. One woman said that when she first started seeing them, she thought they were cute. But more and more rabbits began destroying shrubs, trees, and grass, as well as leaving massive amounts of droppings behind. The story even turned up on the ABC Nightly News. The jackrabbit population varies from year to year, but jackrabbits will likely continue as a prominent member of North Dakota's wildlife. Today's Dakota Datebook was written by Carol Butcher. I'm Merrill Pepcorn.
Dakota Datebook is produced in cooperation with the State Historical Society of North Dakota, with funding by Humanities North Dakota, North Dakota's largest lifelong learning community.
I'm Dave Thompson. Our guest on this week's Legislative Review is the House Minority Leader, Fargo Democratic Representative Josh Boucher. We'll talk about his caucus's priorities for the session and how a minority party can make a difference. Join us at 6:30 p.m. Central Time, 5:30 Mountain, here on Prairie Public.
That's it for this Thursday edition of Main Street. Coming up tomorrow on the show, the North Dakota Legislature has been very busy, and we are having a journalist roundtable discussion focused on the many bills in front of legislators right now. That's coming up tomorrow on Main Street. Until then, enjoy the rest of your day.